The only reason they're called deficiencies and diseases and disorders is because the normal brain said that. They're superpowers.
I feel like you gave me the power tools to work on the category. And I feel like the biggest insight is this languaging in reference to the problem. Like, I have no idea what the category will end up. But the idea, like the thing that I feel like you've given me is that it needs to come out of the problem. Like that's where it needs to come from.
The problem for who? Because branding is about us. Category design is about customers. So who's the who that's having the problem? Ha ha ha. Here's the insight. In every market category, there's roughly 8 to 10% at most of the customers that drive the whole thing. Like almost 90% of the profits. It's not the 80-20 rule. It's more like the 8% rule, right? And not only are they the ones that spend the most, they evangelize the category, they drive. Category design is also, from an execution point of view, the only strategy, the only business strategy that is fundamentally built on driving WOM, word of mouth.
Welcome to Innovation Leadership. I'm Jess Larson. I'm really excited about today's episode. I wanted Christopher Lockheed on the show for a long time, and lucky for me, his team reached out. I was like, hard yes, for sure. So thanks for making time to be on the show today.
It is absolutely my pleasure, Jess. Thank you.
So I love the book Play Bigger so much. I've recommended it to so many CEOs, read it multiple times. For people who, well, let's do the quick background on, you know, three-time CMO of public companies, entrepreneur, all this kind of stuff. Give us the highlights of growing up, born in the good old Great White North and dyslexic paperboy who became an entrepreneur.
You pretty much got it. The only other thing I would add is, I think like a lot of entrepreneurs, for some entrepreneurs, entrepreneurship is a way up. And those are the kinds of entrepreneurs we, I was getting my PhD in super ding dong chemistry at Harvard. And I thought I would leave and start this incredible company. And now I'm a bazillionaire, right? So those are the kind of the mythical stories that we hear. And look, those are great stories and those are great entrepreneurs. However, for many of us, entrepreneurship is not a way up. It's a way out. And so I'm the result of a single mother and, a tough childhood and a lot of love, but a lot of struggle. And so at 18 years old, you mentioned I was dyslexic. I actually have 4 or 5 learning differences. I put them all together and call it dysfunclia. And the thing about learning differences is they're superpowers. They're not deficiencies. The only reason they're characterized as such is because normal brain people said that's what they were. Because we don't fit in their thing. But I digress.
Have you read the book Hunters in a Farmer's World?
No, I haven't. It sounds like
it's
a great title.
It's so good. It's so good. It's the reason that, well, they go through and statistically show you, like, even centuries past, about 3% of the population had this genomic marker for, like, wanting to go over the mountain to see what's on the other side. The other 97% wanted to stay home and farm. And, do you know that book Driven by Doug Brackman? It's my second favorite for weird people.
You're giving me a hell of a reading list. Driven.
I look at it like, when I read those books, I think, I just want to rebrand ADD because as far as I'm concerned, if you don't have it, it means you have CDD, creativity deficit disorder. So you got one or the other. Do you know what I mean? You either got attention deficit disorder or you got creativity deficit disorder.
What if all these things they taught us were bugs or features? So here, you want to have a specific on this one? So I'm dyslexic as and I have dyscalculia too, which is the dyslexia of math. And so, look, I've written 14 number one bestsellers. Well, how's that possible? Because I can't read or write. That's what they said. Dyslexia is a thinking superpower. And in my case, I also have ADHD. So I'll give you a very specific example. I used to chastise myself in my own brain up until not that long ago when I was writing, because as I'm writing, I chase zebras, because I always chase zebras, right? And so I'll be writing something about Jess, or maybe I'll make a note in a newsletter, hey, I was on this podcast, awesome guy, really cool to meet him, blah, blah, whatever. And then I'll go out to the internet to grab part of your bio or something. Well, now I'm out for 15 minutes. I mean, there'll be multiple zebras. The squirrels will be juggling the chainsaws. Who knows? I might have to see what Selma Hayek is up to on Instagram. There's all sorts of things that could happen, right? Well, I used to chastise myself for this. I used to try to correct this. And then one day I went, are you mental? That's part of how you learn. That's part of how you do this. That's part of how you think. And I could give lots of other examples. Point being, the only reason they're called deficiencies and diseases and disorders is because the with normal brains said that. They're superpowers.
There is such an overvaluing of the skills we have and an undervaluing of the ones we don't, especially if other people are like us. And I think you should come back on and we should do a whole nother episode just about this. Because I have a lot to say and I know you have as much as I do. Just for reference, those companies, these giant companies, when you were the chief marketing officer, how big were they when you were CMO, like market cap wise or something like that?
I joined Vantiv when they were already public, but they were sort of maybe medium by the day's standards. By today's standards, small. I'm trying to remember what the revenue would have been. I'm going to f*** it up, but I'm going to guess maybe 150 million, somewhere in that range. I could be wrong. And the market cap would have been maybe a couple billion at one point, probably under a billion for a lot of the time I was there. Again, I'd have to go look, but rough and tough in there. We're talking vintage 90s client server applications, and in this case, a company that started off in the services category and then ultimately, like everyone else, morphed into CRM. So that was that one. And they acquired a little boutique company that I had in Toronto. And that's actually how I got down here. And then after that, I was the founding CMO of an internet services and consulting company called Cyent. And we became the leader in the category. And in, I think it was the first quarter of our third year, if I'm not mistaken. So now vintage, late 90s, heading into the crash. But I think we were maybe three and a half years old when we went public, and we had a $9 billion market cap, and we were considered to be the fastest growing services company. We soon thereafter became the fastest shrinking services company because our entire business was around putting people up on the internet, or what today you might call building websites. And we probably got to, I'm trying to remember how many people. I'm going to guess somewhere between 1,500 to 2,500, sort of in that range. We had offices in Europe and Asia. And then the last one was Mercury, and the company ultimately was acquired for $5 billion. By Hewlett-Packard in 2006, back when that was a big number. It was the biggest software acquisition that HP had ever done at the time. And I think we would have had maybe pushing up on 3,000-ish people, roughly half of which were in Tel Aviv. And that was an extraordinary company. And they were already public when I joined them.
Well, I just wanted to give this level set to people, to like just give a little bit of flavor where you're from, and I don't want to go over what category design is. I want to do a brief definition, but I think literally 100% of people listening who haven't bought the book just need to like push pause right now, go to Audible, get the audiobook, and then listen to the rest of this episode, okay? So for let's do like a quick version of what category design is, and let's dive into real questions.
So I don't, not to be cheeky, but there's a lot of ways I could answer that question. Which way would you like me to answer it?
Some intelligent founder, CEO is listening and has been living under a rock, and you're trying to have them understand the difference between we're going to put some marketing wallpaper, like put lipstick on a pig, versus like what you do.
First of all, category design is a business strategy. It's not some marketing nose-picking activity. Let me come at it in a couple ways. Number one, we all know what the failure rate of venture-backed startups is, or startups of any kind for that matter. It's in the high 90s, most people say. And even if it's in the high 80s, it's not great. And so we want to do, as entrepreneurs, we want to do everything we can to increase the odds. Secondly, category design stands with, if you sort of zoom out at the highest level, just for simplicity, to be successful at some kind of scale, you need to get three things right. Product design. What is this thing we're making, delivering? Company design. It's our business model, our culture, et cetera. And category design. And what category design is the strategic choice about how, when, and why we're going to compete, and how we can so radically differentiate ourselves that we become synonymous with a problem, because she who owns the problem becomes the solution. Now, a little bit of data. When we were writing Play Bigger, my brother from another mother and I, our Ramadan, started to talk about wanting to know something. And the something we wanted to know was most strategy books, most marketing books, things along those lines, talk a lot about market share. And market share is a very valuable, important thing to understand, absolutely. But what we wanted to understand was, in any given market category, what percentage of the value created as measured by market cap slash valuation for private companies goes to the market leader and then the number two and et cetera, et cetera. We sort of, you know, had an understanding of what that was typically like with market share, but we wanted to understand with value of space as defined by total value of companies in space. So we went to a whole bunch of smart people at Stanford and a few other places, and we said, did anybody have this data? And we were told in no uncertain terms by multiple very smart professors, A, no, and B, if this is what you want, you're going to have to go do it. So we did it. It was a giant pain in the ass. God bless Al Ramadan. He led the project, and it was extraordinary. And here's the aha. And this data ultimately got peer-reviewed and published in the Harvard Business Review. In technology, on average, in any given market category, one company earns 76% of the value created in space. The question then is, how do you become that company? And part of the answer is you become the perceived leader around solving a giant problem and or accessing a giant opportunity for a certain set of people. And if you own the problem, if you own the creation of the opportunity, you become the solution. And then the last piece I'll say is virtually every entrepreneur, CEO, marketer, creator, or innovative person of any kind makes an assumption, an undiscussed, an unconsidered, an undialogued, massive assumption that what we are doing here is we are going to compete. That's what we're doing. Vast majority of marketing books, strategy books, it's all about competing. Michael Porter, all of it, innovator's dilemma, the whole thing, right? So what we're doing here is we're going to compete, and how we're going to win is we're going to have a better product, we're going to have better distribution, we're going to have a better brand. And once the world sees how much better, faster, cheaper, bigger, smaller our carbidingulator is compared to their carbidingulator, they're going to buy from us because it'll be obvious. As a matter of fact, all we need to do is put a demo of our carbidingulator next to their carbidingulator on our website, and we're going to be billionaires. So they make an unquestioned decision that they don't know that they made, which is we're going to compete with a better product brand. And here's what they never consider. She who designs the category wins. Everything is the way that it is because somebody changed the way that it was. And the person who changes the way that it was is the person who creates different, exponential, new value from nothing. So fundamentally, that's category design.
I love it. Okay. So since I actually get to talk to you, can I tell you my new attempt and you you give me advice what I should do instead?
No, I want to, I don't care what I think. I care what you think.
Okay. So I think that there's a lot of guys my age who wish we could have been pro snowboarders, but instead we got a job and had kids and stuff. But now we have some money, unlike previous days past. Okay. And we take our kids to go live our dreams. We go like snowboarding and surfing and go to all these places that we wish we could have gone when we were 15, but we didn't have any money, right? And our kids get these great lives. But the problem is when you go there, the places that you stay are boring, expensive, and not made for action sports people. There's nowhere to put your bike. There's nowhere to dry off like all the snow that's dripping off your snowboard and your boots. Yeah, you're trying so hard not to wreck somebody's Airbnb or hotel room. Like, they're not made for us. Like, you can be at a ski resort, and it's not made for us. And so for our commercial real estate fund, I have this thought of, like, I don't have a name for the category, but this idea of, like, what if we created a category of, like, a small resort that is made specifically for these action sports families like me and my friends? That are you familiar with Woodward? Like where all those action sports kids go to train for X Games. Have you heard of this place? Like the big jumps into the foam pits?
No.
Okay,
but tell
me. It's a brand across America. It's like if you're training for the Olympics, you're training for the X Games, you go to Woodward. So all the hardcore action sports kids, it's like the Mecca. It's like the coolest, like the cool rich kids got to go to camp at Woodward, right? Kind of a thing. So my idea is like, what if you could sleep at Woodward? Like if you're going to go skiing, if you're going snowboarding in Jackson Hole anyways, we want to have the most fun place you can stay if you're going to go there anyways, where it's like, it's a mini Woodward, but the only people who can ride the terrain park and the zip lines and life-size Jenga sets and all stuff are the people who are staying there. And instead of it being expensive, we are really embracing the Warren Buffett low-cost producer. Like, we've been researching for the last handful of years using non-traditional building materials. We think we can build these tree houses and tiny house cabins at less than half of traditional construction so that we could offer like a family of eight can stay for $140 a night or something like this. Okay. And then the idea is that it is so artistic. It's like going to a museum. Like the whole thing is a giant outdoor sculpture garden. It's just some of the sculptures you look at, some of the sculptures you get to ride your bike off, and some of the sculptures you sleep in. And it's like the whole place is Instagrammable, like to the point of like we're a pre-made story for architecture magazines, where they're begging to come to the opening and be the first one. And that all of these like 20, 30 unit properties we do across the country and later the world, that it's one of one. Like that we're building giant 20-foot custom CNC machines right now so that we can build structures that's extremely hard to copy because you can't buy our materials, we make them ourselves. And so like if you want this picture, there's only one place in the world you can get it, and that's that property of ours. You can't even get it at our other properties. So I don't know what this like action sports hospitality category would be, but I don't see anything like it. And so this is my premise. Tell me what you like, what you don't like, what I need to ask myself, where I'm lying to myself.
I love it.
Okay.
And we can go on a magical mystery tour together, can't we, Jess? ADHD theater. So, context before the answer. There's an architect named John Jurdy. And people in the architecture world knew him for who he was because he was the designer, the architect of the 1984 Olympics. And he also designed the most visited place in the United States of America. Most people think it's Disney World. It's actually the Great Mall of America. John Jurdy's the guy who put a roller coaster in a shopping mall. And John, God rest his soul, was the godfather of a different category of architecture. In the architecture world, the people who are praised are the people who build the super ding-dong elite museums and like that. John was the godfather of placemaking, and he wanted to make places for everybody. And one of the things that he said to me, because I knew John and ended up on the board of his company for a handful of years, it was fantastic. He said to me, most places are placeless. So think about what we've done to America. It's the same f-ing Starbucks. It's the same Gap. It's the same. Look, every year millions of Americans eat at the Olive Garden and they think they eat at they've had Italian food. Think about that for a f-ing second, right? And so every f-ing town looks the same. All the houses look the same. They're built in these developments, et cetera, et cetera. And so the whole everything looks the same. There's nothing unique. And so they are placeless. John said that how you make place is deliver unique experiences, one-off experiences. And John said that to Peter Uberoth. And that's why Peter hired him to be the architect of the 1984 LA Olympics. And that's why John was hired to build the largest private development in Japan, Canal City in Hakata, Japan. He's a saint there. Anyway, why do I share that with you? That's what you just said. So what I heard when you said what you said was a Venn diagram coming together in my head of things that you were connecting, right? That made your idea, that is to say, category design, different. You also, Jess, interstitialed problem with solution. And if I remember correctly, you started with problem, and if you didn't, you got there fast, but I think you started with problem, did you? You did? Yeah.
Yeah, I read the book.
No, so you got it. And not what I'm saying to you is not only you're doing category design, you're doing category design by intuiting what the godfather of placemaking, and I know because I know John, or knew John, God rest his soul, the man, not casually, deeply. You're an intuitive placemaker because you understand that and you've combined it with category design and, of course, your other skills. I mean, you have a deep background in a bunch of areas in order to pull this kind of thing off. So I can't tell you whether or not it's going to work, but what I can tell you is it's you've discovered a brilliant missing or a problem that a lot of people would love solved. Because it is, you know, it's funny, I was just talking to my friends about this. You want to take your family to North Star at Tahoe, and you have three kids. Yeah. Like, thousands of dollars. It's $200 a ticket. Like that, right? It's a bazillion bucks. That's nuts. So I love it. And if you want, we could unpack what will increase the odds of it being successful now that you've got the high-level category design. We could drill as deep into that as you want.
Well, I'd love to. And, you know, one other test, again, because I'm like a play bigger devotee, is I thought, would I be happy for other people in this category? And the truth is, yes. Like, I would genuinely love copycats who could build one-of-a-kind places that are not like, everybody throws this word experience around in hospitality. I watch all the talks from the biggest travel conferences in the world, Skift and stuff. And they always talk about experiences. And usually they mean like a new flavor of coffee in the hotel room. Like the bar for what an experience means is so low, it's laughable to me. I would love,
by the way, if other people created... Have you had Joe Pyne on this podcast? Jess, sorry to interrupt you.
No,
who's
that?
Joe Pyne? You know who Joe Pyne is? Okay, you gave me a bunch of good ones. Joe Pyne is the godfather of experience. He and his partner wrote a book in the late 90s, maybe 2000, but somewhere right around there, called The Experience Economy. They saw this whole thing. This was long before Jobs came back to Apple and made experience design a duh. This was before Rob Burgess at Macromedia, who deserves a ton of credit for this whole idea of experience matters, launched Macromedia Studio MX with the tagline of what we would call point of view in category design terms. Great businesses deliver great experiences. And ultimately, they ran ads that said, experience matters, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, it caught on everywhere, not just in software, right? And Joe saw the whole thing, and he's got new shit, and he continues to think, and he's awesome.
Okay, well, you know what I'm buying as soon as we get off this call.
yeah,
I would love
absolutely.
To unpack this. I would really love to unpack anything that can increase the probabilities that, you know, like, it sounds cheesy, but I almost feel like it's a bit of a calling. Like, this is like year 22 as an entrepreneur for me, and I failed at a whole bunch of things. And most of them were to make money. And like, oddly, like, this is the one I feel like so incredibly called to, which, funny enough, I actually wonder if it'll be the thing that makes the most in the end.
So, yes. And I s*** you not, yes. Like a very serious yes. Now, look, I'm radically biased in this domain, and I believe in the free market, and I believe in capitalism. So if you want to be a mercenary and go make money, God bless you. As long as you do it legally and you're a good person, go for it. I don't identify with that, and I don't think many entrepreneurs do. Some, for sure, but I think a lot of entrepreneurs are how you've just described yourself, Jess. And as kooky as it sounds, and maybe I lived on the left coast too long, although I'm a radical independent, so I argue with everybody all the time. but we write about this a lot in Category Design and Category Pirates, this idea of a mission-driven entrepreneur. And most that are successful are, certainly the ones that we admire most are, almost to the point, let me ask you this question, where you can't not do it?
I, you know that question, like, what do you think about when you're not thinking about anything? It's like our charity child rescue or this.
Category design has me by the balls. I don't think it. It thinks me. I tried to f*** it off. And get it off, and turn it off, and stop it, and even after Play Bigger came out, I was like, "All right, here it is, boom, excellent." No, it got worse, or incredibly better, depending on your point of view. You know, one of the greatest gifts you can give yourself is a problem worth dedicating your life to.
Well, I look at it, you know, we've got a loneliness epidemic in this country. I look at, like, so many of the best memories I have in my life was my parents dragging us out to Waterton National Park in southern Alberta, Canada, and hiking and mountain biking and, like, in nature with people you love. And, like, I just think, I don't know. Maybe it's just me, like, living out my 15-year-old boy dreams of, like, I want to invent what I wish existed back then and still wish existed today, and I don't see anybody else even attempting.
Yeah, listen, you're talking to a little boy whose father took him to the Laurentians just outside of Montreal. I don't know, every other weekend for an incredible amount of my childhood, who took me to Jay Peak, Vermont, and Smuggler's Notch, Vermont, and Mount Washington, and canoe camping in Algonquin Park when I was, I don't know, 11, 12, 13. Yeah, cub camp and my dad came to the cub camp. He was, you know, a whatever, dadster or whatever they called him, you know? And so my dad gave me the outdoors and gave me adventure. You know, to your point earlier about the farmers and hunters, I've climbed a lot of mountains in my life, you know, figuratively and actually. And and look, this might get me in trouble. And I'm not saying it has to be this way. Absolutely not. It could be any way. And my experience with a dad doing that with a son, it was very powerful. A very powerful thing for a man to teach a boy.
Yeah, you know, nature doesn't go out of style. So give me a tip. Tell me things that can help me pull this off.
John Muir. There's no problem in the world that can't be solved. One of the core teachings of category design is called languaging. And what languaging is the strategic use of language to change thinking. Because another tenet of category design is what we're doing is we're moving the world from the way it is to a new and different way. And we put them together in a portmanteau called Frodo's for fun. If you want to move the world from the way it is to a new and different way, and you use existing language, it doesn't feel that different, and it doesn't feel that exponential, and potentially worse, it can be referential to the from in a damaging way. Because here's what we're doing, and this is a very big unlock for people. You know, category design is, yes, something you learn, but it's more something you get. And not everybody gets it. And some people think it's intergalactic. A lot, actually. But for those who get it, it's a big aha. And so here's the aha in this area. We introduce new language, and a demarcation point in language creates a demarcation point in thinking, which creates a demarcation point in value, which creates a change in action. So, let me make it as simple as I can possibly make it. We have a piece of technology that goes on your wall, is large, it collects data from space and presents TV and movies and sports and shit. And you can go into Costco and you can bring a good size one of these things that is pretty state of the art. For how much, Jess?
I don't know, $500 or something.
$250.
Yeah, you can get a giant one for $500.
Yeah, giant, like you take it home when your wife is pissed because you actually, it doesn't fit on the wall, kind of. That's $500, right? But like 250, you're way in business. Okay, now, you go out and pot, there are people who will go out and buy a pair of sunglasses for fashion reasons, for, you know, light sensitivity reasons, whatever, and pay $450 to $650 for a pair of super ding dong sunglasses. Yes. So you just step back for a second. One of the other core foundational kind of, if you want to think about it this way, is mental scaffolding of category design is reject the premise. Challenge the way that it is. Immediately reject the premise. So if you zoom out from this for a second, you go, yeah, one thing that's literally the most state-of-the-art technology ever built by humankind that talks to space, that sends you the 49ers game live. Oh, and by the way, it looks better than it does in person. And you can pause it and take a pee and grab another beer. And you can rewind that. And then you can make burgers. And then you can blast through the commercials, et cetera, et cetera. This thing's insane. And it's $300 or $250. And the other thing is twice the price. So here's the aha. Everything we value, we've been taught to value. And so what we're doing with the languaging is we want to use new and different language, because you can't describe an exponential breakthrough with existing language, or at least only existing language. And that's why we'll pay such a different price for something that seems, if you zoom out and reject the premise of the way that it is, a little ridiculous. But everything we value, we've been taught to value. Here's one of my favorite examples, Starbucks. So you can't charge $5 for something that currently costs a quarter if you call it the same thing. So they make up new words that sort of sound Italian-y, like you should probably know them, but you don't. But the first time you hear them, you sort of pretend you know them because maybe they're actual words, you're not sure, right? I was around when Starbucks took off, you know. I remember when, mid-90s being in Vancouver, and there was a block in downtown Vancouver, Jess. Do you remember this? I shit you not, on all four corners there's a Starbucks. Do you remember this?
I believe it.
Yeah, I don't know if it's still the case, but anyway, here's the aha. Triple grande latte changes the perception of value. It's milk with coffee warmed up. But that sounds like a terrible way to describe a double grande latte or a venti ding dong kabangi or whatever they all are, right? So my point is, Starbucks doesn't get to radically change the perception of the value of their product from a normal coffee by creating new language. And their language becomes the language of the category. So in your neighborhood, do you have a super ding-dong hipster avo toast serving, you know, paint the Picassos in your drink kind of a coffee
place?
Well,
my office is about 16 minutes from, like, more of those than you can count down Main Street in Park City.
Okay, that's, yeah. Okay, so you ever notice, you ever go in there and ask them for a double grande latte and see how the hipster behind the counter looks at you?
I can imagine the disdain.
Yeah, they want to rip out your throat. Another example that we love is Sarah Blakely. First of all, She refused to call it anything other than an invention. It was an invention. She's an inventor. And the reason her Wikipedia page says inventor is because she told everybody that Spanx was an invention. Point A, radical differentiation. Now, if she said it was a Girdle 2.0, you and I wouldn't know her name and nobody would own them. She said, no, it's a new invention, aka category, called shapewear. That's way better than a girdle, isn't it? Who wants to wear a girdle? Oh, you're fat and look terrible, buy a girdle. Oh, why don't you get some shapewear going, and I'm quoting her, you'll feel more comfortable in those white pants. Because she had the white pants. You know this story, right? Though everybody knows the white pants story. My point is, she designed the category. Everything about it was different. Brand Spanx, category shapewear. Radical differentiation, invention. She's the leader.
Pulling it back to my, Woodward sculptures you could sleep in. How do I, what does my decision tree look like as I cycle through options and explorations?
So here's the first thing. What's the problem? And so we want to spend a lot of time thinking about the problem. Yes. So yeah, go through it with me.
Boring, expensive, doesn't actually do what you need it to.
And indoor, or? Because the outdoor piece is part of it, or no?
Yeah, so these will all be like off-grid outdoor places with the bike jumps and all the like, think like Disneyland in the woods for action sports families, right? But you can only ride them if you're staying at the teepees, right?
What we want to think very hard about, Jess, this is where creativity and innovation and thinking comes in. Another part of the mental scaffolding of category design is thinking about thinking is the most important kind of thinking. It's actually the first law, and it's in the 22 laws. And so a lot of thinking about the problem. And so ways to think about the problem include when you're experiencing the absence of this, that is to say the way that it is, what are you experiencing?
It's a mediocre experience at an expensive thing that doesn't actually solve your problem of having a place for you to put the longboard, surfboard you brought with you.
For John Jurdy, the word was placelessness. And the interesting thing about that word is people have one of two reactions the first time they hear it. One, oh, that's cool. Wait a minute, what? And then they think about it and then they start getting it. And then some people who are not actually able to think reflectively, they just think reflexively and therefore don't really think. Go, oh, that sounds stupid. And they don't consider it for a second. You know, so what? The point being, it gets their attention. It's different. So when John says most places are placeless, they're anywhere places. Most airports are anywhere airports. You don't know where the fuck you are. Marriott. A Marriott is radically placeless. Every Marriott, plus or minus, looks the same. And the design point of the Marriott is to be predictable, reliable, and bland/non-offensive. And not one person in the world ever said, that was a awesome Marriott lobby. Now, that's their advantage. But their business model is predicated on, we're radically placeless. That's what you're getting. And that was the machine that John raged against. And sounds like you are, too.
I heard Seth Godin give this exact talk. He said, turn the lights down, turn the lights. He's like on stage doing his marketing spiel, right? And he says, look at this. Turn the lights. I turn the lights down slightly. Can anyone tell me what brand of hotel I'm in? Am I in a Hyatt? Am I in a Hilton? Am I in a Marriott? Can anybody tell me what square box with a bathroom and a TV I'm in? No, none of you can.
Exactly. Placelessness. A placelessness. That place is placeless. And have you ever
and you're sick of getting your socks wet. You know, you want to put on a new pair of socks? You're sick of getting your socks wet when you went in the kitchen because all the melting snow off your snowboard ran in there. And you're like, is there anything worse than finally getting warm and then your socks get wet from snow melt?
I feel your pain because wet boots on a cold morning suck. Yeah. We want to frame, name, and claim the problem. And your missionary zeal becomes about eliminating that. That's why you don't care about competition. When Elon Musk open sources the patents, that's why. He said, look, we can't make this category go. My words, not his, but we need this to be adopted. A, for business reasons, and B, hey, and you believe him, you cannot believe him, you can lie, not lie. I'm not advocating him. I'm just telling you what he said. You know, we need this to help the planet. So here it is, go. And more recently, the industry standardized on their charging technology. And I don't know the ins and the outs and the puts and the takes, but my general understanding, Jess, maybe you can tell me if you know more, is he did the deal in a way that wasn't punitive for his competitors. I mean, maybe he makes money or whatever, but whatever he did, he didn't smash them all, right? He did it in a way that made economic sense. So bam, here we go. So these are things that missionaries do.
I'm going to have to re-listen to this episode like 5 times, but this languaging stuff has really helped me in a way that just rereading the books, I don't think I was picking up on. And
you know, Chuck Berry wanted rock and roll to go. That's why he wrote songs about how cool rock and roll was. No, well, I shit you not.
It's so helpful for me because I've really struggled with naming the category and naming our brand both because
don't do
of the
brand
referential
until you got
thing.
The category.
But the, your referential
because
thing
a brand in the absence of a category is a really dumb thing to do.
Well. And I finally have, like, this has been so helpful for me to, I feel like you gave me the power tools to work on the category. And I feel like the biggest insight is this languaging in reference to the problem. Like, I have no idea what the category will end up. But the idea, like, the thing that I feel like you've given me is that it needs to come out of the problem. Like, that's where it needs to come from.
The problem. For who? Because branding is about us. Category design is about customers. So who's the who that's having the problem? Ha ha ha. Here's the insight. It's a radical insight. Absolute genius, backed with data. Eddie Yoon, author of Super Consumers. And my partner in our writing band, Category Pirates, one of the most extraordinary human beings I have ever met, Eddie Yoon, incredible. Here's the insight from data science research. In every market category, there's roughly 8 to 10% at most of the customers that drive the whole thing. Like almost 90% of the profits. It's not the 80-20 rule. It's more like the 8% rule, right? And not only are they the ones that spend the most, they evangelize the category, they drive category design is also, from an execution point of view, the only strategy, the only business strategy that is fundamentally built on driving WOM, word of mouth. Because here's what nobody, you know, nobody in the marketing and branding world is going to tell you the truth, which is the most legendary marketing is, was, and always will be word of mouth. And so the question is, how do we drive WOM at scale? Well, how we drive WOM at scale is we create this thing in category design called a point of view, or POV for short. It's basically a very sophisticated way of saying a story that frames the problem, evangelizes the problem, paints the picture of the promised land, and then the third piece sort of writes itself, which is operators standing by. Go to www.jessisawesome.com. And so that simple model, but focused on the customer. What's the problem? So, and the insight with super consumers is build the category design, build the product, build the company, culture, business model from serving supers. People make a giant mistake with this. They try to serve everybody. Get the supers. So, when you know who that person, that company, that buyer, that user, that tourist, that visitor, that adventurer is, and you know who the supers are in the space, get clear about the problem, frame, name, and claim the problem, go on a mission with the supers. To quote the Big Lebowski, this aggression will not stand, man. Right? That's why they're missionaries. You know, my friend Sachs talks about building a movement. You know, my friends at Sequoia were looking for mission-driven founders, right? Because it's when the problem owns you. And this problem already owns you. And so now what's missing is the category design and the languaging to bring it all to life. And you're close. However, if we go back to the first law, you have to learn how to reject the premise and to do what Roger Martin calls reflective thinking as opposed to the reflexive thinking. Oh, that's stupid. Well, and we all do it, all of us. Of course we do. But reflexive is, wait a minute, what do I think? If you're somebody like me that's verbal, I've never been celebrated for my brevity. You can allow yourself to think out loud. I, on a regular basis, say, I'm having this thought. I have no idea if I agree with it, but let me say it. Or I don't know if I agree with myself. Or I reserve the right to disagree with myself later. Or I don't know. I don't know if this is really stupid, really awesome, or makes me an asshole or a genius, but this is what, you know, whatever it is. So give yourself that permission if you're that person. And if you're not that kind of person, however you think reflexively, that is to say, actually consider abortion. We all have an opinion immediately. Boom. Well, how often do you go, well, wait a minute. Let me just open the aperture on my mind for a sec. Okay, so why does that matter in terms of your category design? Most of the thinking that we do is in the context of the as-is category. Our friend Mike Maples at Floodgate has this concept called backcasting as distinct from forecasting. So here's an exercise we recommend. It's 5 years in the future. It already happened. Our wildest dreams and then some, like a bunch of legendary shit on top of that, that we couldn't even have imagined on top of our most outrageous dreams for this new exponential different future that we want to create, that we're missionary about, that we're obsessed with. It's already happened. Look back. and write down the story of what all, what happened, as opposed to what most people do, which is they stand, their brain is situated in the current, aka the way it is, aka the category the way that it is, and they say, what do I need to do from now to get to there? What Mike is suggesting, and what we now teach in category design, is get there, envision there, hang out there, do like get your executive team together, do a workshop, hang out, drink beer, whatever you want to do, have fun, go snowboard. That's how we like to write, by the way. But anyways, and live in that, and live in that it already happened, and then backcast to today. Mike says that legendary entrepreneurs are visitors from the future telling us how it's going to be. And if you just pull on that thread a little bit, anybody who's ever known a legendary entrepreneur knows that they are insanely pissed off at the way it is. They are irascible about it.
You
the
know,
way it
too-
is in the world. Go.
I'm going to interrupt you. 2 hours ago, I was doing another episode, and I was talking about Play Bigger. And it's a guy named Jonathan Siddharth who built a $4 billion AI company called Turing. And he literally said, well, what I feel like my job is at all times is to be like at least 3 years, in my continuous improvement, to be at least 3 years out from where the company is. That's like how he frames his job.
Well, that's what category designers are. And the way it is makes them bat until they get it. Was it a documentary? I had COVID and I ended up watching just all this cool documentary shit. Anyway, I forget where I saw this, but it was an Eddie Van Halen documentary about how he created his famous Frankenstein guitar. And the guy just could not get the sound that he wanted from a regular guitar. And so he just went to work like an insane person and tried all sorts of shit. Like, absolutely, like, what is he doing in the garage? And why is he doing it? Like, he won't even eat. That sort of, yeah.
So great. Obviously, I think everybody needs to go buy their copy of Play Bigger, Niche Down, 22 Laws. I mean, like, all the things. Is your website the best place? Where should people should be going?
Yeah, categorypirates.com.
And we haven't even talked about your podcast and your Substack and your... Tell everybody the other places they can drip your wisdom.
On all the regular podcast platforms, two podcasts. One is a long-form dialogue podcast, so... just like this, called Folly or Different, with people who have done something different in a radically exponential way. I started off as kind of a business podcast and still has that theme, of course, but we've gained reputation over time. And so, you know, now we're blessed to have some of the most fantastic authors, at least, you know, to us, in the world come on with incredible research and big ideas and incredible stories. And so we have a lot of those types from all sorts of domains, from, you know, academics and artists and musicians, and then go back to Silicon Valley and startups and technology. And so it's for the business person with a different mind. And then a marketing podcast called Lock It on Marketing that's more educational in nature. We do have guests on from time to time, but a lot of solo episodes unpacking a part of marketing and or category design or responding to questions or things like that. And those tend to be much shorter. The solo ones are, you know, 15 minutes. They're a real joy. I didn't know what I was doing when I started. You get to have these conversations. People put down their phones, they look each other in the eye, they hang out. I'm not surfing the web, you know, I'm not chasing zebras, neither are you, paying attention, playing verbal catch on shit you care about, or you find interesting. That's the greatest job in the world.
It's funny, you know, like other people's podcasts have been way more successful for mine, but I have had like 4 million downloads so far, right? And people want to talk to me about the audience all the time. I'm like, you guys, I would do this show if literally, goose egg, if zero people listened, I would still do all 900 episodes over again for the guest. You people think it's about the audience. You've got it all wrong. Like, it's so great when you get an email from, you know, I had the city of New York call me, say, wrote me this email. Love your podcast. We need your services. I've got a budget. When can we talk? Like, that's the best email you can receive as an entrepreneur, right? Okay. Don't care. It like this is like the most fun hobby ever. If nobody listened, I would do this anyways.
And listen, long before I became a podcaster, I was a podcast super consumer. And like all entrepreneurs, I started Follow Your Different because it was a podcast I couldn't find. Most business podcasts are wankers playing cartoon character like Gary VD or all these guys, right? And then I wanted long form, real dialogue about substantive things in business that were not with a bunch of, you know, that were as a real conversation that I want to hear smart people. And we had these podcasts in other domains, but very few at the time, what the category we called real dialogue podcasts in business, that were, you know, some cartoon character and some trying to sell you some, I don't know what.
This is so fun. I really hope you'll come back.
Yeah, anytime.
Okay, bye everyone.